Welcome to Richmond Law and Policy's podcast series. Richmond Law and Policy is a social justice law firm specializing in consumer protection class actions, representation of nonprofits and progressive businesses, and civil rights litigation concerning police misconduct. Our first season gets to the core of systemic issues regarding factory farming and is intended for educational purposes only. Welcome to Richmond Law and Policy's podcast. This is your host, Jack Einstein. Today, Richmond Law and Policy's Senior Factory Farming Legal Fellow, Jay Schuster, will interview Danny Diamond, Director of Field Operations at the Socially Responsible Agricultural Project.
Hi, all. I'm Jay Schuster. I'm the Senior Animal Welfare Legal Fellow at Richmond Law Group. At Richmond Law Group, I work on false advertising litigation against animal agribusinesses, specifically focusing on companies that make claims such as natural, humane, and sustainable type claims about their animal products. And today, I'm really excited to be interviewing Danielle Diamond, an attorney and the director of field operations for the Socially Responsible Agricultural Project. Danny, do you want to introduce yourself further?
Yes, thank you so much, Jay. I'm happy to be here, so thank you for having me. And as Jay mentioned, I'm an attorney, and I'm also the director of field operations at SRAP, as we would call it. And basically, I direct all of the organization's local community campaigns that we have going on across the country, and essentially all of our field work that we have going on across the country. I've been with the organization for over a decade and have worn a few different hats, but SRAP is the only organization that I'm aware of that has a complete focus on assisting communities that are being impacted by factory farms, or what we call CAFOs, at the local level, but we do so nationwide. And we respond to requests for help and adjust whatever assistance that we provide based on that specific community's needs. And I should also mention that while I'm an attorney, SRAP does not offer legal services or legal representation, but one of the things that we can do to help people is to try to direct them to legal resources when they need them.
Great. And can you tell us some of the key different approaches that you might use to fight a CAFO?
So these can range from trying to invoke government environmental permitting and other types of regulations to nuisance cases and trespass actions and to community organizing. But I would be remiss not to mention that many laws and protections that are available to people to address problems from other intense industrial activities aren't necessarily available to people who are being impacted by factory farms. And this is because large corporate agribusinesses exert a significant amount of political influence over our regulatory agencies and our lawmakers, to the degree that the industry has pretty much written the laws for itself. And they've done so under the guise and imagery of the traditional family farm. And there's a cultural bias in this country to protect the family farm. But when it comes to CAFOs, we're talking about impacts from a heavy industrial land use. These are intensive livestock production facilities that often house thousands or even millions of animals, producing as much waste as some cities. So those, they can have a multitude of negative environmental, public health, and other types of impacts that exceed and escape the boundaries of the land in which they're located. So oftentimes, environmental laws and regulations that would apply to other types of industry that would have similar impacts don't necessarily apply to CAFOs for the reasons why I just stated. And often when responsible governmental agencies fail to act, we'll provide our community partners with training and guidance on how to monitor and document and report pollution that's caused by CAFOs to try to help inspire government enforcement. But when there aren't applicable laws that are helpful, that are on the books, common law nuisance suits might be an option. And we also definitely encourage people to engage in organizing campaigns to reform the laws and regulations so that they are more protective. And often pollution monitoring and data collection by citizens can help push for those types of reforms too.
Great. So I'd love to hear some more details about these various different approaches you were discussing. And so can you start by just getting into the weeds a bit about what a nuisance action is?
But basically, they prohibit anything that unnecessarily or unreasonably damages or devalues the life or property of others. So when a property owner does something on their property that endangers others on their property, that may be considered a nuisance claim. And if you bring a nuisance suit, a court might order that that entity, whatever it's doing, to stop doing what it's doing, or might be liable for any damages that they've caused. So nuisance laws can vary from state to state. Some states have statutes on the book that outline what nuisances are and how they can be enforced. And then also courts rely on common law, which is basically previous case precedents, to guide their decisions.
Great. And could you share a little bit actually about like who a typical plaintiff, like who's actually able to bring a nuisance suit?
So someone in the circumstances that we work in, it's often the neighbors that are surrounding where a CAFO is located. Because as I mentioned before, a lot of times the impacts from those CAFOs, they go beyond the boundaries of the land in which they're located, and they impact surrounding neighbors and other landowners.
And what are some of the, just so folks can get a better, more concrete understanding here, what are some of the key types of harms that these factory farms do impose on neighbors? So like in what ways do plaintiffs typically argue that these farms interfere with the use and enjoyment of their property?
So there's basically anything that would interfere with the use and enjoyment of your property could include anything from odor that makes it so you can't go outside, or flies that, you know, are everywhere. Sometimes it's dust, sometimes it's feathers. We've seen people having feathers fly over onto their property, and you know, it could be any multitude of things. Basically anything that is interfering with your use and enjoyment of your property, so it makes it so that you can't enjoy your property as you normally would, like for example having a barbecue with your family because the odor is so bad, or being able to go outside and garden because the, you know, the dust and air emissions are making you sick. It's anything that interferes with what you would normally, your property rights essentially, and that is to use and enjoy your property. There's different types of nuisances, and we've seen nuisances in all different kinds of contexts. Sometimes they can be considered trespass actions too, when you have something that's invading someone's possession of their land. So with nuisance, you have an invasion of someone's use and enjoyment. And then with trespass, there's sort of an invasion of someone's land itself. So the conduct by a defendant in a nuisance case could result in a trespass action or a nuisance action or both. But generally, trespass cases would be when the conduct of the defendant leads to an interference with a property's owner's possession due to maybe dust or feathers or runoff escaping their property and going onto someone else's. So some kind of physical objects moving over or being deposited on the plaintiff's land. And oftentimes the trespass action, there might need to be some kind of intentional act of that or knowingly done. Whereas nuisance could be something that's maybe noise pollution or light pollution, and public nuisance. There can be a public nuisance action brought when there's a condition that wrongfully injures or endangers the public's health, safety, or comfort.
Great, thanks. That's very helpful. And if you are a neighbor of one of these facilities, how would you decide, you know, in which context, whether and when you should actually bring one of these actions, and whether you should invoke trespass law or actually nuisance law or both?
So that's a really good question. And I think the answer is it's always going to depend on the facts of the particular situation and what applicable statutory laws or common laws are in that particular state in which the person lives. There may be reasons to bring one kind of suit or the other, or bring both types if there's some kind of physical invasion that can be proven. But there is a difference. Every state does have what are called right to farm laws that really dictate when someone can bring a nuisance type action against an agricultural operation. And those have a lot of impact on whether or not someone has the ability to bring one of these suits. So if you're interested in learning more about what a right to farm law might look like in your state, there's the One Rural Justice Center that's hosted by the University of Kentucky that has a developing interactive map that provides info. You can click on each state and you can learn about its right to farm law and what prohibitions or protections there might be for agricultural operations that may limit a citizen's ability to bring that type of action based on their state laws.
Thanks. And I think it might be helpful if you could just talk a little bit more about what a right to farm law is exactly. And also, I think it's confusing for a lot of folks, understandably, because right to farm law sounds like a good thing, right? How could you be opposed to the right to farm? But what it's, I think you're saying here is that right to farm laws actually are laws that restrict the ability of neighbors of factory farms from being able to actually bring the types of claims that you have discussed so far, like nuisance and trespass claims. Is that accurate, or could you elaborate?
Yes, I'm so glad you brought that up, because traditionally, or when right to farm laws were passed originally, the intent behind them was to protect agriculture from the encroachment of urban or suburban influx, and so to protect agricultural lands from those the influx of other types of land uses. But over time, they have evolved, and there have been a lot of amendments. These right to farm laws started becoming really prevalent maybe in the 70s and the 80s, and since over the years, they've, in my opinion, because we've done a lot of national research on this, they've developed in such a way that they really protect agribusiness interests more than real traditional family farm operations. And so they are tailored in such a way, or there have been amendments to these laws to where it makes it very difficult for someone to bring a case against a industrial livestock operation, for example, because it's put in the same category as a traditional family farm that's growing crops and is diversified and is small and it isn't having any impacts or as intense of impacts as a factory farm would.
Thanks. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, that sometimes it may even be genuine small family farms that may have their use and enjoyment of their land actually impaired by neighboring factory farm. And so the factory farm could actually be impeding on a small farmer's right to farm. Is that right?
That is so true. And it's so common. It's so common because factory farms, they are generally located in rural areas, and the surrounding neighbors typically are farmers. And so what you have is one type of farming or intense agricultural use impacting the surrounding farmers. And we have many people that we work with that have been on their land for generations farming. And a factory farm comes in and they have a very difficult time defending or protecting their own farms because of these right to farm laws.
Well, yeah, thank you so much for elaborating on that. So I think now I would like to move on from what sounds like the common law nuisance and trespass type claims that we were talking about before, and now focus a little bit more on some of the regulatory regimes like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And so could you talk a little bit more about how to bring claims where you can invoke these provisions to help factory farms come into compliance with the law and stop polluting?
Yeah, so this, the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act you mentioned, The Clean Water Act, I'll start with the Clean Water Act. That used to be the primary federal law that was used for regulating CAFOs, and it was done under the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, or the permitting system that basically controls pollution from point sources. And that applies to all industries. At one time, nearly all CAFOs were required to apply for these water pollution control permits, like all other industrial industries, unless they could certify or prove that they had no potential to discharge or didn't propose to discharge. However, after a series of challenges on the federal level by agribusiness industry and other groups, and in my opinion, US EPA succumbing to some industry pressure, those regulations were weakened significantly over time. And now they only really apply to facilities that are considered dischargers in fact, or that can be shown to have this continual discharge. Well, CAFOs aren't allowed to discharge by law anyway, except under certain circumstances. So most claim that they don't discharge and therefore they don't voluntarily apply for this type of permit coverage. And now, because of the way federal law is written, they aren't required to apply for Clean Water Act permits under federal law. But those permits really are a very good mechanism for controlling the pollution, because they set forth different standards and different ways that CAFOs are supposed to manage their waste that really is intended to prevent pollution from occurring in the first place. But now we have a little bit of a reactionary permit scheme where a facility might not ever be required to have a federal NPDES permit unless it's discharged and it has had continual discharge problems. And that's basically how federal law stands right now. With that being said, states should and could enact stronger measures than what the Federal Clean Water Act puts in place. That's basically the minimum standard. And a lot of states have delegated authority to administer laws like the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. And many have the ability to enact more stringent regulations than what those laws have in place. Unfortunately, what we've seen happen in a lot of states is that when the federal laws weakened, so did some of the regulatory programs that the states were implementing. However, there are some states that still maintain those laws and that go above and beyond federal law and require all of their CAFOs to have these types of permits. And so this is a really important way that CAFOs can be regulated and that people can actually weigh in on how their waste is managed and whatnot. So, but if you're in one of those states that has this reactionary permit scheme, much like federal law is now, one thing you can do is you can document CAFOs that are mismanaging their waste or they're causing water pollution, sometimes to U.S. waters or state waters, however that is defined in your state. And it is possible to trigger permitting requirements like federal NPDES permits or equivalent state permits, which also place restrictions and regulatory controls like regular monitoring and reporting of waste handling and disposal and on and on. And so, again, it depends on what state you're in, but the Clean Water Act does have that permitting scheme, although it's become a little bit harder to regulate CAFOs under it unless your state goes above and beyond what's minimally required by federal law.
Thanks so much for that. I do want to just ask some clarifying questions for folks. So to make it a little more concrete for listeners, I wonder if you could explain a little bit about, just by way of example, when a Clean Water Act case might be viable and when it might not be viable. And so just for example, if I'm understanding correctly, it needs to be a circumstance where the Is it true that the actual facility that you want to sue regarding needs to actually have a permit in the first place? Because I think you were saying before that a lot of farms are not technically, they may not have permits. Is that right?
Can you? Yes. So you can under the Clean Water Act, CAFOs are not allowed to discharge unless it's considered an agricultural stormwater discharge, which means their land applying in accordance with certain standards, and there's a certain weather event that creates a discharge. Those are exempt types of discharges, but generally speaking, CAFOs are not allowed to discharge under the Clean Water Act. Some CAFOs may have Clean Water Act permits already, so they might be regulated under a permit. Many CAFOs are not, because they claim not to have a discharge. So if you find a CAFO that is polluting, you can have a Clean Water Act violation for discharging without a permit. Now, if a CAFO has a permit, it could also be found in violation for discharging if it's not operating in compliance with the terms of the permit. So there's two scenarios: discharging without a permit or not, you know, discharging out of compliance with the terms of the permit that a facility may have.
And if somebody is discharging, so let's take the first example, discharging without a permit, what does that actually look like? So would that be like a farm that does not have a permit that says they don't discharge, but every time it rains, a bunch of water runs off from their farm that's contaminated with fecal matter, comes onto your property? Would that be an example of the first scenario?
Yes, as long as it doesn't qualify for that agricultural stormwater exemption, discharges from land application areas would be considered illegal unless they meet certain requirements. And a CAFO has to be land applying in ways that really ensure that there will be the adequate uptake of nutrients in the plants and crops in which they're growing. But to simplify that a little bit more, yes, if a CAFO is discharging from either the facility itself, sometimes there's an open lagoon that will overflow, and that overflow can reach waters of the state or waters of the U.S., or sometimes there will be leaks from equipment that will cause a discharge, or oftentimes it is from land application areas, from mismanagement of waste. So those discharges, that might not necessarily trigger a permit requirement. So for example, in some states, a CAFO might have an isolated event where it causes a discharge. A state like Illinois is a good example. The state of Illinois right now, if a CAFO has a discharge, one discharge event, the state might not necessarily say, okay, you're a discharger and you have to have a permit. The state might say, if you correct that problem, you might get fined for discharging without a permit, but if that's not going to happen again, you won't need a permit because you're not a continual discharger. You haven't had repeat violations, for example. And so in states like that, you really it is important to show sort of a pattern if you want to try to trigger that permit requirement.
Great. And so let's take the other example where someone does have a permit. And actually, before we do that, a discharge, what in the plainest terms, a discharge is what exactly? When any water pollutants run off from a farm's property to someone else's property? Or can you maybe clarify that as well?
Yeah, so I guess CAFOs, this might get a little bit too on the wonky side of things, but CAFOs are considered point sources under the Clean Water Act. So under the Clean Water Act, you have a point source, which is generally a pipe of some sort that an industrial facility actually is, you know, discharging its waste into a river or stream. That's a traditional point source that, you know, you can see it. And the pipe going from the industrial processing facility, a paper mill, for example, and it is allowed to pollute a certain amount through its permit and just goes right into the waterway, as long as it doesn't exceed certain thresholds.
And so it sounds like if you are a neighbor of one of these facilities, like the kind of classic thing you might do to try to document this happening would be if you saw like a consistent, every time it rained, a consistent stream of brown water coming from your neighbor's farm going into some river, that would be the kind of classic case where you could show a discharge is actually occurring here.
We try to provide people with trainings and whatnot, so they know what to look for. So how to monitor for these types of violations and these pollution events and do water testing, and then how to document them so you have some evidence that's actionable, and then how to report these violations. Really important thing is to document when you're seeing these happening through photographs, or if you have water testing strips or whatnot. And that's something my organization, we have a whole program that's dedicated to really giving citizens the ability to do this so they become their own citizen scientists and their own regulators. And quite frankly, US EPA and the states, they often don't have the resources or the political will to be regulating this industry the way it needs to be. And so really, people that live near these facilities are the boots on the ground and are the ones that are going to be able to say, there's a problem here. Because generally speaking, a CAFO entity is not going to voluntarily seek permit coverage. If they have permit coverage and they have one of those discharges like you mentioned, where there's a land application that they did properly in accordance with the terms of their permit, and there's a rainfall event and it discharges, they might be exempt from any kind of enforcement. That's what's called the stormwater discharge. But most CAFOs, that's a benefit to seeking a permit for a CAFO, but most don't voluntarily seek permit coverage. So what the need is for people living near and around these facilities to document when these pollution events are happening, not only to try to get regulatory agencies to act, but also for bigger policy efforts to try to get stronger laws in place. Because what we know is virtually all CAFOs discharge. It's just whether or not they get caught.
And so the one last question I have on that is with regards to how you catch them violating the permits when they actually do have a permit. Is that also by using like water testing strips? And are there other methods? Like if I'm not mistaken, I think you can also sometimes, there are certain government records that might be public.
Yes.
And you can those as well.
Yes. I'm glad you mentioned that, because whatever the terms of the permit will say, oftentimes they require the CAFOs to do regular monitoring and reporting of their waste management practices. So that's one way, is to, you know, you can submit a Freedom of Information Act request to an agency to see if a CAFO is doing regular reporting like it should be. You can also look at the terms of the permit. And if it's an NPDES permit, the facility's waste management plan becomes part of the permit. And so the terms of the permit, which usually has different kinds of restrictions in place to control pollution, as well as the facilities, that specific facility's waste management plan, the terms of that all become enforceable. So you can, let's say, for example, a facility is not supposed to land apply waste within 24 hours of a predicted rainfall event, and you see them out there land applying in the rain or within, you know, an hour of a huge storm, that would be out of compliance with the permit. If you're driving down the road and you take a picture of that happening on that date, you actually have evidence of a permit violation without the water pollution being shown, because you're just showing that they violated the terms of the permit itself.
So I keep saying I'm going to move on, but it's just so interesting. I just want to know, how do you get those permits? Like if you're a neighbor, one of these facilities, how do you actually get a hold of it?
So you can, that is a very good question. I'm glad you asked it, because if we're talking about a federal NPDES permit, which some states do require CAFOs to have just on their own, sometimes there's a lot of work that goes into trying to trigger that permit requirement for a CAFO. But those permits, actually, before they issue, the public has an opportunity to weigh in and comment on the permit and the terms to try to ensure that it's adequate. So it's going to be protective of waters and whatnot. And so there is a public input process before any CAFO permit issues. And this includes, even states often have general permits, which cover a whole industry with one permit. even when a CAPO is seeking general permit coverage, it has to submit a waste management plan, and the state agency has to put that out for public notice and allow the public to weigh in on it before it actually issues. And so that's one of the benefits of having one of these permits, is you can actually have an opportunity to weigh in. And then if you need to access to the permit or the terms of the waste management plan, you can down the road submit a Freedom of Information Act request to the agency and get a hold of those documents. Whereas if you have a CAPO that's unpermitted, you don't have access to that type of information unless the state has some kind of equivalent permitting program.
Thanks. That's really helpful. And frankly, as with many types of public information, you would really think that these should be publicly accessible on a website, and you shouldn't need to file a public records request to know if your neighbor is violating the law. But yeah, that's very, very helpful to know.
Yeah. And you know, Jay, I know we got stuck on this issue a little bit, but just on that note, there are states where you can go online and they'll have all their CAFOs and their permits available online. There are certain states that do that. There are certain states that require all CAFOs to have permits and NPDES permits that have been approved by US EPA that also act as state permits. So sometimes they go above and beyond. So for example, I'm thinking of Wisconsin. They have WPDES permits, and their permits go a little beyond federal law, where I believe they regulate some groundwater pollution. So that goes beyond just the surface waters that the Clean Water Act regulates. But that might be one of the states where you can actually go online, because every CAPO is required to have this kind of permit, and track down that information. And that's another thing that our organization helps people do as well, is figure out where to find this information if it is available. But I will say, and I'll use Illinois as another case study, where people don't have access to that information because there is no permitting scheme and there is no transparency. And that's also common too. So again, it just depends on your state, whether or not that information is publicly accessible and how easy it is to get.
And in terms of who can actually file a case and how, do you need to report it to the government before you just run off to the courthouse and file a lawsuit? I know you mentioned about that there's a requirement that the agencies need to fail to diligently prosecute or something before you can file a lawsuit.
Yes, that is the citizen suit provisions under the Clean Water Act. And they might be a little bit different under state law. Again, it depends. If you find a CAPO that's in violation, you have to provide the state and I believe the federal EPA notice, as well as the violator, that you are going to file a citizen suit. And they have a certain time period, I forget if it's 60 or 90 days, to where you give the state or federal EPA an opportunity to act. And so oftentimes, once you file a notice of intent to file a Clean Water Act citizen suit, that can inspire an agency to actually step up and enforce the law. And we've seen that. So that's an avenue where you might not even have to go through the whole citizen suit process. You are required to give agencies and the violator notice before it goes to the next level. And so, yes.
Well, thank you so much. And I think we could probably talk for hours more about the Clean Water Act. But perhaps, we should move on. I think there was one other law, the Clean Air Act, that you mentioned that perhaps you can provide a brief overview of and how.
Yes. So the Clean Air Act might be a law that's triggered for CAFOs that emit certain pollutants at certain levels. And it doesn't necessarily apply to all CAFOs, but if you have, in some cases, a certain size of facility that will emit certain pollutions that exceed the amounts that the Clean Air Act regulates, then that could trigger the Clean Air Act. And the Clean Air Act has been implemented by US EPA, and for states that have this delegated authority, states also implement and enforce the Clean Air Act. So there's two entities that could be involved. About 10 years ago, US EPA issued National Air Compliance Consent Agreement that basically gave CAFOs the opportunity to participate in a study to study their emissions. And that study was intended to help EPA and CAFOs estimate when they might be meeting these thresholds under the Clean Air Act. Any CAFO that signed up to participate in that study got some immunity if they ended up having Clean Air Act violations during that study period. Well, that study's been completed for quite some time, and many CAFOs are still basically claiming that they're not regulated under the Clean Air Act because US EPA hasn't published its emissions estimations methodologies, I guess you could call it. So the data that came out of that NAME study, they call it, the National Air Emissions Monitoring Study, EPA hasn't finalized any rules or actual factors for facilities to be able to estimate their emissions. They have put some things out. So there's a lot of data and science that's available for CAFOs to do that themselves. But EPA hasn't published any official methodologies yet or estimates. And so many CAFOs are claiming that, and states as well, are claiming that the Clean Air Act doesn't apply. But when in fact, there really are ways to estimate the emissions coming from these facilities because there is a lot of good scientific data out there. And CAFOs, particularly those that didn't participate in the study, are subject to the Clean Air Act, even though they might claim they don't meet those permitting thresholds. It is something to look at. And it's a little bit similar to the Clean Water Act in that oftentimes it's citizens that live in and around these facilities or that are about to see a large facility come in that are the ones that are making the case that the CAFO is going to be exceeding air pollution standards. And they're the ones that have to push government to actually regulate these industries properly.
Great. And can you just briefly explain what are the air pollutants that come from these places? Because, you know, typically when I think of the Clean Air Act or air pollution, I'm thinking of a smokestack with some kind of smoke coming out of it. And that's not what we're talking about here, right?
Well, in some situations, CAFOs can look similar to that because they house animals. And, you know, with CAFOs that are housing animals in buildings and confined buildings, they do have, you know, they have to have a way to get rid of the bad air, right? So there is sort of not necessarily a smokestack that you'll see, but you'll see huge fans that are blowing out air pollution basically onto surrounding neighbors, because if the air were actually contained within the facility itself, the animals would die. And so I'll just use a case example that I know of and I can differentiate it to a feedlot, which is a very large poultry operation in Arizona. I think it was housing up to 8 million or more birds, and there are fans on the outside of the buildings that's blowing out all these emissions. In that particular area, that facility, there's a number of different pollutants that CAFOs can emit that are regulated under the Clean Air Act. There are a number of other pollutants that aren't necessarily regulated, but in that specific case, VOCs are one, so volatile organic compounds. That's one regulated pollutant under the Clean Air Act. In this case, in that area, under that state's implementation plan, and it was already in a non-attainment area, which means this area where this CAFO was in was not attaining its air pollution standards, I guess you could say. So they had a lower standard to meet. So maybe 100 tons per year would be the level for VOCs. Well, we could calculate that this facility, given its size and the pollutants that it was going to emit, was definitely exceeding that threshold. And so that's one example of, almost a point source air discharger with the emissions coming out of those fans of the poultry buildings and going out into the environment in the form of VOCs. That's one. And I know that in other cases, for example, feedlots, it's a little bit harder to prove because you have this open area where you don't necessarily have, you know, a discrete conveyance of the air pollution going from inside the building to outside the building. But they're all, you know, those also in some cases can fall under the Clean Air Act as long as the emissions aren't considered fugitive, which is basically the, yeah. So those are a little bit harder to regulate, but the, but they do tend to emit some of the pollutants that are regulated under the Clean Air Act as well.
Great. And can you just explain for folks who, like me, don't really know what a volatile organic compound is, like what's bad about these pollutants? Like, what are some of the negative issues that residents in a neighboring area might face as a result of this kind of pollution?
So VOCs are, these are harmful pollutants that can cause respiratory illness and other public health problems and contribute to even global warming.
Is this a law that also has a citizen suit provision? If I think someone's violating the Clean Air Act, can I sue them directly? Or how do you actually hold them accountable for violating?
Yes, I believe the Clean Air Act does also have citizen suit provisions, much like the Clean Water Act. And so there are ways to try to get facilities in compliance with the law. And with the Clean Air Act, it's because of the name study, and many states are not even enforcing what they have on the books, often it is up to citizens to really push these cases and bring them to the attention of regulators. So definitely citizen suits are one available option to do that.
And so, you know, we've talked about a lot of different strategies so far, from nuisance to trespass actions to Clean Water Act and Clean Air Act. How do you decide, you know, which types of actions are suitable? And specifically, I'm wondering if you can talk about how the specific area where somebody lives might impact what avenues will be successful for them.
Every state has varying types of environmental regulations that could apply to these facilities. Many states have been given delegated authority to administer federal laws like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, and they create their own programs to implement those laws. And so some states might have requirements that go above and beyond those laws when they have that authority. And then there are some states that haven't been delegated that authority, where EPA is the entity that will step in, and then you're relying on federal law. So there's that. Each state might implement the federal regulations in its own way. But then there also might be other laws that a state would have, environmental regulations or whatnot, that go beyond the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act that would apply. And in addition to that, in addition to state laws, different states give different powers to local governmental entities. So in some cases, you might have county level governments or other public entities that have regulatory powers. So you could have an ordinance, local ordinance in place that could regulate a CAFO in your state, depending on whether or not the state has given that authority to those governmental bodies. And so, again, it depends on what state you're in. There might be federal law that applies. There might be a mixture of state and federal law, or you might have state, federal and local laws that could be triggered. But I would like to again mention that if oftentimes these laws are not adequate in terms of regulating this industry because they have been weakened so much over time, or there is this cultural bias not to regulate farms. Again, we're not talking about farms, we're talking about industrial production facilities, which should be regulated differently. But in many states, and it obviously, as I explained with federal law, these laws don't do what they need to do to protect people. And so that brings us back full circle to nuisance actions and common law nuisance and what the state allows in terms of those types of cases. And we have these right to farm laws that have provisions nowadays that are very effective in shielding CAFOs from nuisance liability in various ways. They put time restrictions on when you can file a nuisance case. They have fee shifting provisions that are very unfair, where a plaintiff would end up having to pay the other side's attorney fees and costs if they lose, but that doesn't necessarily apply to the defense side. And then some laws specifically exempt CAFOs and other agricultural businesses from nuisance suits if they're operating in compliance with any applicable state and federal regulations. But if you have state and federal regulations that are non-existent or ineffective, it's not very hard for a CAFO to show that they are meeting those provisions. And so it makes it a very high burden for people to be able to bring those types of cases when you have those types of right to farm laws.
We've talked about it a lot, and there's clearly, you know, a lot of different avenues that can be pursued by somebody who wants to, you know, fight back against factory farming. And we've talked about the fact that there are a lot of different barriers that people need to be mindful of, and whether it's right to farm laws or different regulations at different places. So considering how complicated this could be, what should folks do who are actually directly affected by these issues? What kind of next steps should they take to address them?
So depending on what state you live in, there, like I said, there could be different laws that apply. One avenue that we recommend is to monitor, document, and report pollution and other suspected violations to agencies for enforcement, and then apply public pressure on those agencies to act. In some states, there are those citizen suit provisions that allow people to step into the shoes of regulators to do enforcement if violators aren't being diligently prosecuted. But then if those laws fail or prevent people from protecting themselves, we encourage communities to organize and to build alliances to push for needed policy changes. Education and organized public pressure sometimes is one of the only options that people have. The SRA Project, the organization that I work with, has a help hotline that people can find on our website, and we can help people, guide people through some of these things. There's also the One Rural Justice Center that's hosted by the University of Kentucky that has a developing interactive map that provides information on each state's right to farm law. There are some state farmers union chapters that can help point people in the right direction. And then also Farmers Legal Action Group and Public Justice's Food Project are places that people can go to look for legal support and other resources.
Well, I think that covers everything that I wanted to cover. Is there anything else that you wanted to add before we go?
Well, I just appreciate the fact that you are doing this podcast, and it's been a pleasure to talk to you, Jay. So thank you so much for having me. And yeah, thanks for everything that Richmond Law Group is doing in this realm.
Yeah, and thank you. And I just can't emphasize enough how I really hope that this podcast and obviously your broader work, I really see it as being able to empower people that are currently feeling disempowered. And they can. I hope that this provides somewhat of a concrete roadmap for people to actually take action and stand up for their communities. So yeah, thank you so much for that. And look forward to working together more in the future.
Special thanks to Jay Schuster, Danny Diamond, SRAP, Flag, One Rural at the University of Kentucky, and many others for making this podcast possible.